Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Vroom vroom.
Why did I know you were going to start up right there? I know you so well. How many years? 15, 16 years or so? Yeah. And that's like when it's going to start.
And a few car rides together as well.
If you started with a choo-choo train, I would have been worried. But I'll take the vroom vroom, and we're going to explain why. So welcome, everybody. This is the ITSP Magazine, and this is in particular the channel that we just renamed Audio Signals. So we kind of capture the signals, we spread it back to our audience using all we can, and we hope to be able to tell good story. That's our goal, Sean.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've told a few, even a few from the road, from the car. I remember one on the beach, even. We were driving around.
Yeah, with horses.
There were horses on the beach too, yeah. Autonomous.
So we go all the way back to horses. And then from horses, we're going to go into cars. And this is what the story is about. But it's not cars. We're not going to review any particular cars. This is the story of the autonomous cars and where we're at, where we started, and what happened in between. And there is actually a guest, Alex Davis, with us that wrote a book about it. And so we want to know everything about it, or as much as he wants to tell us, without inviting people then to buy and read the book or listen to the book. So, Alex, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to this, Alex. And for those who may not be familiar with who you are, maybe just a few words of what you've been up to and what led you to an interest in automobiles and transportation.
Yeah, I'm a journalist. I'm currently a senior editor at Business Insider, where I run the transportation desk. Before that, I spent 6 years as an editor at Wired Magazine, also working on transportation coverage. And especially during my time at Wired, that tenure coincided nicely with kind of the rise in popularity of the self-driving car and what we might now call somewhat the inflated expectations of the self-driving car. And then ultimately kind of the decrease in that hype over time. But I'm a technology journalist, and while working at Wired, I carved out the time to write a book that is less about what's happening right now in the world of autonomous cars and more of a history of this space and how it is that we got here.
And that's always an interesting conversation, because sometimes we forget how we get somewhere. And I was a little worried when you said the race, and I was like, I hope it's not fall of the autonomous car. Thinking about David Bowie and Ziggy Stardust. But definitely some people, and we hear those all the time, they're like, why don't we have this car in the street right now? So maybe looking back and looking at the process that what has happened, then there are people that are asking why they're not flying cars, but that's a completely different story. Maybe not completely different, but you know, that's not what we're talking about today. So I was reading a couple of things, how you kind of look back in time, obviously, and there's mention about the DARPA first grand challenge and how things kind of got shaken from that. Is that what inspired you as well, or a different thing?
Yeah, so a good chunk of the book is actually about those DARPA challenges. It really forms the first half of the book. I think about the book in two big parts. The first half is the story of these three DARPA challenges, which were open races for autonomous vehicles that happened in 2004, 2005, and 2007. And what's interesting to me about that time is that's when a lot of the people who are leading the self-driving industry today first got into it. This is when they first started working on autonomous vehicles, proved that they had the talent to make it happen, and came together into teams, first to compete against each other, and then ultimately coming together at Google, and then at places like Uber and Ford and GM and creating this whole industry. But my thesis, so to speak, is that in those three DARPA challenges, what you get is proof that the self-driving car is possible. Proof that if you put the right people, the right brains with the right software, with the right hardware in a room together, you can actually get a car that drives itself. Maybe not perfectly, but the technology is there. This is something that can be accomplished. And what I look at in the second half of the book, which is the rise of Google's self-driving car team, and then the arrival of Uber as a competitor, and what's happening in Detroit as the big automakers start to cope with this idea that the very nature of driving could be changing underneath their feet. For me, the arc of that second half of the book is what happens when people realize that this technology is not just possible, but inevitable. And that's the story that I'm trying to tell. I think of it very much as an origin story, almost like a superhero origin story. I'm going to take you from when all of these men and women were graduate students or undergrad students, or even some high schoolers in here, and how they kind of come along the way to create this technology and then race forward and try to bring it into the real world.
Sticking with the looking back parts, when I look at technology in general, because we can do something, we tend to try to do it, even if it's not the right thing to do. And we often just take, okay, there's this box. If we round the edges, we can make it into a rounded edged box. I guess my point is we tend to take something and try to make it something else versus perhaps even taking a step back and saying, what do we want to accomplish and how do we get there? So I'm wondering from an autonomous vehicle perspective, are we working with existing parts and trying to make them autonomous, or do you see folks kind of breaking everything apart and forgetting what we have and really moving forward with what is the goal with autonomous vehicles?
So the original goal with autonomous vehicles, at least within my story, actually comes from Congress of all places, in a 2000 bill, which was just a routine military funding bill. Someone worked in there, Senator John Warner of Virginia, worked in a thing. He thought that he wanted to see more autonomous vehicles in the military because he knew about the Predator drone, which had started flying in the 90s. And he said, oh, this is great. It keeps pilots out of harm's way. Why can't we do this with ground vehicles? Because we know, especially in the early 2000s, and this became more important as we started to get mired in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and a lot of soldiers were being injured by IEDs while they were driving in vehicles. The idea was, what can we do to get American troops out of these vehicles so that maybe we can just have trucks running supply missions and you don't have to put any human life at risk? So this congressional bill included one little line on page like 600 or something. And it says, by 2015, the American military should make 1/3 of all of its ground vehicles unmanned, which was a completely insane goal. And the idea at the time was, okay, well, let's like kind of light the fire under some people and see if we can make this happen and speed along this technology. And the organization that picked it up is DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. DARPA is like the kooky, secretive arm of the Pentagon. They're the guys who created the internet and GPS and also Agent Orange and also the stealth bomber. So something of a mixed bag of accomplishments, I guess, depending on your political point of view.
It's the ultimate skunk works.
Yeah, exactly. And so it came down to DARPA to say, okay, well, how do we rapidly accelerate the development of this technology so that we can get American soldiers and troops, you know, out of these vehicles? How do we make more unmanned vehicles? And because the technology at that time, they'd been funding all sorts of research into this stuff for decades by this point. And a lot of the basic building blocks were developed. Very basic software for doing this. Some of the more fundamental tools like cameras and radars and extremely limited versions of what we now call LIDAR. Those all existed. And so the idea that DARPA had, the DARPA director Tony Tether said, well, you know, we're paying all this money to these big contractors, to like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and they're just not making the kind of advances we want to see in this field. So what happens if we just open this up to anyone? We're going to have a contest. We're going to call it the Grand Challenge. It's going to be a race through the Mojave Desert in California. Anyone is invited. Anyone who can like get a car, throw some cameras, some radars on it, put a little software in it, and we'll bring them out to the desert and we'll race them. And whoever covers this 140-mile stretch first is going to get $1 million.
How did that go? I mean, I know it's a rhetorical question because it was like 7 miles, right, or something like that.
Yeah, it went terribly. The 2004 DARPA Grand Challenge, in the most immediate sense of the race, was a disaster. It's 15 vehicles made it to the final round, made it through qualifying. And of those 15 vehicles, the one that went the farthest came from Carnegie Mellon, which is the premier robotics institute in the country, oldest. Some of really the world's top robotics work happens there in Pittsburgh. Their vehicle went 7.4 miles before it got stuck on a rock, and it spun its wheels so fast that they caught fire, like the rubber burned off. And a couple other vehicles went like 4 or 5 miles. One got stuck on a different rock. One was going up a steep hill and lost power and rolled back down. There was a big 16-ton military six-wheeled vehicle from Oshkosh that got confused, that ended up stuck, quote-unquote, between two bushes because its software was saying, well, no, like those are immovable objects. So you have this enormous truck just going backward a few inches and then forward a few inches and stuck between these two bushes. And then maybe the most high-profile flop of all of those comes from Anthony Lewandowski, who's now a very well-known name in this space. He came to the race with an unmanned motorcycle that he called a Ghost Rider. He decided to make the challenge 10 times harder on himself by taking away the advantage of four wheels. He brought his motorcycle to the starting line. He let it go, and it instantly fell over on its side. Because he said later he had forgotten to turn on the self-balancing stabilization system on the motorcycle. So his lesson coming away was to make checklists before you go into this. So in that obvious sense, the race was a disaster. Like there was actual things on fire, and no one got anywhere near the finish line. The vehicles barely got out of sight of the grandstands. But what's really interesting and the bigger sense in which it was a success was that it proved that there was a lot of interest in making this technology real, and it got all of these, in particular, young people from around the country. The Carnegie Mellon team had one big professor in charge of it, but other than that, it was graduate students and undergraduate students. Anthony Lewandowski did this completely on his own. He was getting an engineering degree from UC Berkeley, but he just made his own team with his friends and convinced them to stay by buying them burritos and pizza. And you get all of these teams that say, like, you know, we think we can do this. And while the first Grand Challenge is a disaster and no one gets $1 million, DARPA comes back and sees all of this interest and all of this potential. And they say, we're going to do another race in 18 months. Come back. We'll call it the 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge. And it turns out that those 18 months and some very hard-learned lessons from the first race made all the difference in the world, because 18 months later, 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge, five vehicles finish the entire race. Stanford comes in, wins first place. Carnegie Mellon finishes second. Anthony Lewandowski's motorcycle is still a disaster. but he gets very interested in this technology. And that's really the lesson here, was that what happened with the O4 challenge was bringing together a group of people and putting them in the kind of competition that motivated them to try this really incredible thing.
Yeah. You know, what I'm thinking is, as you describe this, I'm thinking like the race for space, and you know, if you look at the moon and how many rockets have been falling before we actually went up all the way. And it seems like it was crazy at that time, but somebody had to say, look, let's try to do this. And then the crazy genius people are going to go for it. So it's hard to define a success or a non-success, but I was actually reading something interesting, a book actually about the future and technology and how all these things happen, mostly not just because one technology, but because the convergence of multiple technologies. And the electric cars is one of those, of course, and many others in medicine and so forth. And I feel like that's obviously the truth there as well. I mean, you do the first challenge, you realize how far or how close we may be, and you realize exactly by putting it on the ground that it's not theoretical anymore. So the race starts at that point. And that's the title of the book too, The Race. Why did you decide it? I get the car racing, but it's also something more about it. Like, what drives this?
Yeah. You know, I debated using the word race in the title because I think, especially if you look at the field today, which is more mature, there's not going to be one winner. I mean, there'll certainly be plenty of losers. Not everyone will make it. But the idea that, like, there can only be one, whoever finishes this technology first will win the whole market, isn't true. But I use the word race in my title because I think that's how the people in the book actually thought about it. First in the Grand Challenges, there's an obvious race. Those are literal races. You know, it's whoever gets to the finish line first or fastest gets $1 million. But then as the technology starts at Google, so Google is the first company to put serious money into this technology. And what they do is they gather all of the smartest people from the Grand Challenges and they put them on one team. So it's like now all of a sudden you've got the self-driving all-star team. And it's about a dozen people, some of really like the smartest engineering minds in the country when it comes to this stuff, when it comes to robotics especially, which is a very particular and particularly thorny area of engineering, I think. Because you're combining hardware with software and your thing has to work in the real world, which isn't the easiest place to do things. But as they get started and they start showing their technology to the world, other places start to say like, oh, wow, like this is something we need. And that's particularly true of Uber. Uber comes up in the second half of this book as a major driving force because then Uber CEO Travis Kalanick sees Google's self-driving car. He actually gets a ride in one. And he says, like, this isn't perfect yet. But his mind immediately starts spinning and he starts seeing the future in which if all of a sudden he can take the driver out of his cars, Uber, which has long struggled with the question of profitability, he's like, that's the biggest cost center. If I take that out, I win. Like, Uber becomes 1,000 times more profitable. And more than that, he says, not just how it can help Uber, but he says, if someone else develops this and Uber doesn't, then what they can do is they can create Uber 2.0. They can create my company without my expense center of these human drivers. And he realizes that this becomes an existential threat. And it's really Kalanick who comes in with, he calls this winner take all. He's like, I think this is a winner take all space. If we're not first, we're last, basically. And so he enters, he tries to partner with Google. Google isn't too interested. They rebuff him. So he says, okay, forget you. I'm going to create my own self-driving team. And so now all of a sudden you have these two teams in a race. And then it's around the same time, this is 2014, 2015, where the big automakers are starting to wake up a little bit to this world. The automakers who 2008, 2009, several went bankrupt or near bankrupt and kind of went into a bunker. And now they come out of this bunker and they see this whole transportation landscape is changing. And they realize this is technology we need. And all of a sudden it becomes a race not just to finish the technology, but a race to get the funding to do it, to get the talent to do it. And all of a sudden, everyone's just charging forward.
Yeah, and you gave a couple examples. Even the Uber one is a great example of why we would bother with this, right? Why would we bother? And certainly the military has a vested interest, as you said, to save human life as they're trying to deliver goods. Uber to cut a cost center for transporting people around the city. I'm wondering what other areas are we trying to enhance society with autonomous vehicles? And is it big, broad transportation, or are there micro transportation services that we should expect to see coming down the line?
So the biggest upside, and this is the one that any well-trained self-driving CEO will give you first, is just the death toll on American roads. It's very easy to forget because cars are such a daily part of our lives that every year between 30 and 40,000 Americans die in car crashes. And many more than that are badly injured. And there's just a huge economic toll, emotional toll, human toll of all of these car crashes. Traffic is a terrible, terrible thing. And there's an argument that self-driving cars will drive more efficiently, or at the very least, if you have fewer car crashes, you're going to have traffic will move that much better. And then you get into the somewhat grander ideas of how you can change transportation. And this is where the rise of Uber actually creates a very nice use case for a self-driving car, where you get slightly more idealist visions, especially in cities, of how you can move people around, or cities where the traffic is just so awful. And it's becoming worse and worse, especially in newer American cities that don't have good public transit systems that were built very much for the automobile and don't allow many other ways of getting around. The thinking goes that, well, if you can get these autonomous cars and you can use them in a shared way, so either multiple people are in there or you don't need to own a car anymore, you just call one up, it arrives, there's no one inside, you don't have to worry about, is this a good driver or a bad driver? You don't have to give anyone a star rating, and it just whisks you along. You get this very almost utopian idea of how everything can move so much more smoothly. You don't have to worry about parking your car anymore. You don't have to worry about being stuck behind the guy going 50 miles an hour because he's looking to park his car. You don't have to pay for car insurance anymore. You can take that physical space back out of cities and give it to people. You can make little parklets. And actually, you get a little vision of this, what's happening right now, actually, if you look at cities amid the pandemic, where all these restaurants are opening up outdoor dining, and it's not an issue because people are driving less, and because that's the only way these restaurants can survive. But that kind of thing becomes a lot more manageable when you don't have to dedicate a huge chunk of city real estate to parking cars anymore. So you can get into these very utopian visions, but of much nicer ways of using the car to get around, really rationalizing it in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it may be that if you look back in time where we went from horse and carriage to vehicles, motor vehicles, right? Did we have to change the roads to accommodate the new vehicles, or did the vehicles have to fit into the old laneways that are cobblestone? And I'm wondering how that'll change our cities moving forward. And I have this weird vision, it was driven by the pandemic, that we would actually live a big chunk of our lives in our cars. So I don't know how that ends up looking and maybe it's even better if the car drives for us, right? Because we're going to go to the drive-in and watch movies. We're going to go to the drive-through to eat our food. We're going to go to the beach and sit in the car and watch the sunset versus being out amongst people that might be infected.
The pandemic has done some interesting things for the way I think about self-driving cars, because on the one hand, I don't really go anywhere anymore. Just sit in my house. So I think, like, what do I need? Like, I barely need my human-driven car, my me-driven car. But at the same time, like, the importance of getting around and being able to, like, have a certain amount of distance from everyone, which as depressing as it is, like the self-driving vehicle all of a sudden looks a lot more tempting to people all of a sudden. And especially if people in the years after we all get vaccinated and can go back to work, and maybe people still shy away from public transit and more people start driving and traffic gets worse. That's probably not great overall, but it means that if you have a car that drives itself, even part of the time, even only on the highway, that becomes a much more valuable thing, because life in the car can just become that much more manageable and pleasant. You don't have to be driving the whole time. You can, you know, you don't have to only listen to podcasts. As great as much as we all love podcasts, like we can all, you know, you can sit and read a book or watch TV or sleep in your car.
You know, like many of these big changes, it's not just a technological change. It's every technological change that it affect our life is really a social change. It's a cultural change. And just think about the ownership of the car. And how I'm one of those that actually is living without a car because I work from home most of the time. And when we're in the normal life, we just fly somewhere. But of course, you've got to go work every day and you are in LA, you spend 2 hours in the car almost every day. That's a lot of good other things that you could do. Maybe you sleep in the car and you work later at night at home, or you have your hobby, whatever it is. So I think we can start looking at this cultural change of this idea of ownership that is going to make a big difference, in my opinion. And I don't know how fast people are going to let go the car, either the status symbol or whatever that is. So do you touch on this perspective on the book as well?
I look at it a little bit, and one thing I tried not to do too much in this book was prognosticate what the future looks like. And the book is very much centered on the characters, the engineers who actually made this happen. But that gave me the chance to get into those questions as the characters are encountering them for the first time. And seeing and trying to see it through their eyes, especially as this was happening relatively early in the technological history I tell. So it's really around like 2011, 2012 that the Google team starts thinking about this problem a little bit, and they hire their first product people to come on board, and they start doing what they call market research. And the first market research they do is they find the Google employees throughout the company who drive Teslas. And they say, well, these people are clearly like pretty into the future of cars. And they start asking them, okay, like, how do you use your time in the car? Like, what interests you about technological change in the car? And then one thing they realize is like, they do find those people who drive Teslas, but they notice that these Googlers, even for people who make pretty good money, a lot of them do not drive nice cars. There are not many BMWs and Mercedes and Audis. It's a lot of like Honda Civics and Toyota Corollas. And they create this term. They're what they call the uncar people. People who use their cars just because they have to commute, because, you know, Google's in Mountain View and these people live in San Francisco or live in the East Bay in Berkeley and Oakland. And they just need to commute. And they realize that that's their real target demographic. It's not the people who are obsessed with cars. It's the people who just need a form of transportation that gets them from A to B. And they realize these people would be thrilled if they could sit in a car and they could, like, you know, as they drop their kids off at school, they can actually have a conversation with their kids and not stress about traffic. If the traffic's bad getting over the bridge, they can relax in the car. They can get ahead on their work. And that's where they really start to see the potential of this technology coming in.
So we're in a race to some finish, whatever that finish may be. maybe it's not a finish. Maybe it's the first lap that we're on. And it's an
ending. I can't see a finish line on anything.
No, actually, that's why I call the epilogue of my book is called The Starting Line.
Yep.
So we're still pretty far from the finish, but I think what you see now are people figuring out where this technology can work. And people ask me all the time, okay, when is the self-driving car going to be ready? And I say, you're asking the wrong question. You have to ask, where will the self-driving car be ready first? Because if you go to the suburbs of Phoenix, Arizona right now, you'll see Waymo, which is the company that Google created. So when I talk about the original Google team, that's the effort that becomes Waymo. You'll see Waymo cars driving themselves around with people in them. And it's a relatively small pilot program still, or it's a relatively small service in terms of customers. And I think it serves a few hundred people. But those people who are in the program can dial up a car and a robot car will show up. And more now, that car will show up without a human behind the driver's seat, behind the wheel, ready to take over. So in that sense, like, that program exists. I'm not sure. I can't imagine that Waymo is making a lot of money giving rides around the Phoenix suburbs. But it's a proof of concept that you can see working. And what will happen over the coming years is they'll expand that area more and more. They'll invite more people to ride in the cars. They'll cover more and more territory. And maybe then they'll start in other cities. Cruise, which is the self-driving effort backed by General Motors and by Honda, is about to take its safety drivers, who are the men and women who sit behind the wheel in test vehicles. They're getting ready to take them out of the car and let the cars drive themselves around San Francisco, which, like, is a much more dynamic driving environment. I think in the coming years, you'll see more and more trucks. That's a good early starting place. Trucks patrolling the highways, maybe not with nobody in the cab. That might be a big step, especially as people get kind of freaked out by 18-wheelers without anyone in them. But maybe where the driver can take their hands off the wheel and relax, and it becomes a safer vehicle for that person to operate. So I think what you're seeing is this technology arriving in these little pockets, places like autonomous shuttles for senior citizen communities, these things that spread over large areas in Arizona and Florida, and you'll get these little autonomous shuttles. So it's easier for these people to get from, you know, get from their apartment to the swimming pool, to the yoga place or whatever it is. So it is appearing all over the place. I mean, it's hard to call the technology finished. And certainly the dream you might have of the car that sits in your driveway that doesn't have a steering wheel or pedals, that you get in and you say, take me to Target, and it takes you to Target. And you say, take me to the gym, and it takes you to the gym. Like, that's decades away. But the more little concrete examples are coming along. And I think about it, I think the best comparison is not the car itself, the way the car spread at the beginning of the 20th century. It's the internet. Right, the internet was created 60s, 70s, and in its early days, it was not that useful, or it was, had a very few use cases for a very small group of people, right? It was people in the military, academics using it. And over the decades, the internet grew and grew and grew. It became more robust, it became more useful, and it became available to more people. Until now, it's just the obvious fabric of our lives. And I think that's how this technology evolves, is geographically and in size and in terms of usefulness.
I would like to ask you a question, because we started this conversation with a, let's call it an open source project, which is the DARPA challenge. As long as you can get the car going, you're invited to participate. And then it became this big company, even existing manufacturer, that said, you know what, there's money here, or there's a life of death, as you mentioned, for Uber kind of situation. And what's happening now, in your opinion, to that crowdsource ingenuity, or whatever you want to call it? And it's become too much about the money and no more about the inspiration of the people, the technologists that wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, I think certainly the moment money became a real part of it, the sense of community pretty much disappeared. And it's something that Chris Urmson, who was the longtime lead of Google's self-driving car project and is now the CEO of a high-profile startup called Aurora, I was interviewing him about the DARPA challenges in which he played a big role. And he said, you know, he has this sense of nostalgia that he's really glad to be working on this technology now where it's so much closer to being useful and changing people's lives. But he says, as someone like building something, it was much nicer when you weren't fighting other companies. And I think that, you know, that was probably inevitable. And I think what it does is it speaks to the importance and the potential of this technology that you get people fighting and really racing to make it happen. There are other areas, though, where that sense of collaboration would be useful. And it's something where people talk about what's the best way to develop safety standards for these vehicles. And that's still really an open question. And we're stuck in this place right now where we kind of have to trust the companies. Because at least in the United States, regulators have not kept up. They do not have a deep understanding of how this works. And like that's perfectly reasonable. It's an incredibly complicated technology that relies on deep learning and neural nets and really sophisticated software and hardware. And I don't think you can really expect like the US DOT to be fully up to speed on that. But what you've seen is some people in the space say, well, if the government can't do it, and we don't want to just blindly trust these companies saying, oh, don't worry, it's safe. Like, let's remember, like, Uber's test car killed someone a couple of years ago. After they had said, it's perfectly safe for us to be testing in these streets, we've got it. That was clearly not true. And their voice is now arguing for more collaboration between the companies, more data sharing, at the very least to create a framework for being able to evaluate these vehicles. And I think that's where people really regret the fact that all these companies become so closed in on themselves because they're so scared of losing trade secrets or losing ground to their competitors.
Yeah, and I'll make a comment. You feel free to jump in on it if you like, Alex. Otherwise, you can just leave us sit there. But when we talk about safety and regulations and things like that, of course, we always look at the connection to cybersecurity and privacy as well. And I think when we're talking about a race and people competing against each other to do good things for their shareholders, we might find some of them cut corners, or they might not share and be as visible or open about what they're doing to protect their own IP and to protect their own issue or their own business from being compromised. So I don't know. I'm hoping that whether it's government or not, that somebody gets in and helps to ensure that it's more than just safety of the vehicle running tires on the ground, but safety in terms of all that data that it's generating and collecting and sharing as well.
That's true. And that's, I think, a concern that people have been voicing more and more loudly in recent years as you start thinking about how much these vehicles will know about us. I mean, they'll know where you go is the most obvious thing. These vehicles, though, will also have cameras inside them, almost certainly, to be able to keep an eye on what people are doing inside them. And you're seeing that now with cars like Teslas that have autopilot or Cadillac cars that have Super Cruise, which are these, what I call kind of like pseudo self-driving or semi self-driving things where the car does some of the work in certain situations. These vehicles now have cameras to watch you to make sure that you're not unconscious or that you haven't like gotten into the back seat, that you're available to resume driving if necessary. And then I think there's no reason to believe that future fleet vehicles, even like self-driving Ubers or whatever they become, won't have cameras in them. And so the question of data becomes that much more serious. And right now all the companies say like, yeah, sure. Like, don't worry, we take cybersecurity really seriously, but it would be nice if we had some way of actually verifying that they're doing what they need to do on that front.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure there's. I know a few hackers that are working, ethical hackers, of course. That's what we referred to. Otherwise, we say cyber criminals. they're working on it. But it's interesting because I think that's a good way to wrap, actually, with a look at the future where you want your personal assistant or your Alexa, Siri, if we can call them personal assistant, to kind of be good, really be useful. And at the same time, you don't want them to know about you. So where you draw the line of, if you have a real assistant, that person needs to know your taste, needs to know what your schedule, needs to know the things that you do. And you have to rely on the fact that it's an ethical person and it's not going to go to the press and tell weird things about you. So in a way, we kind of need to open that Pandora box, I feel, if we want to have this service. And then again, you go back and show what's always the convenience versus security and privacy. And that's going to be a never-ending story. But I'm curious to see the end of this race, to be honest with you, and excited to read the book as soon as it come out or have it read to me by the assistant, by Siri or whatever it is. Alex, thank you so much for your time. And I know the book is coming out on January 5th. And I'm assuming, I'm waiting for the Audible because I'd like to listen to the book, as I was mentioning before. To learn a little bit more about what happened behind the scene of this race, kind of like in the pit stop, maybe, if we want to make a reference to the Formula One and racing world. So, Alex, thank you so much. And if people want to hear know a little bit more about you or get in touch with you or get the book, you got a few minutes here if you want to use them.
Sure. Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at adavies47, A-D-A-V-I-E-S, 47. And mostly what I'm tweeting about right now is the book and a little bit of self-driving news that we're seeing coming out. And you can find the book. It comes out from Simon & Schuster. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Any major bookseller should have it. It'll come out as an ebook and Kindle edition and audiobook. And all of that becomes available January 5th. So I hope everybody enjoys it.
Sure, we will. Alex, thank you so much, and hopefully we'll have you back on soon and tell us how things are going, and maybe we go to the next chapter and see where this race is going.
Yeah, give me a couple more years and maybe I've got another book in me.
Thank you, Alex. Really appreciate it.
All right, thank you so much, Alex.
All right, thanks.
Vroom.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.